I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. It's always difficult to leave old ways behind and embrace the new, but our guests today, working in very different fields, are dedicated to getting us to do just that. Lou Glaser is urging policymakers in Michigan to let go of its industrial past and move into a future based on knowledge and technology, where success depends on people becoming more resourceful, lifelong learners. Lou is president of Michigan Future. Mick McManus is working alongside public officials to rethink the world of libraries. It's typical of the kind of radical reconsideration of user needs that his firm, Maya, performs routinely for its clients in many fields. We'll talk about changing old habits and adapting to new realities today on Smart City. But first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Louis Glaser is president and co-founder of Michigan Future. He is co-author of 6 reports on the future of Michigan and is currently involved in launching a high school designed to connect students to good-paying careers in the automotive industry. Prior to founding Michigan Future, Lou Glaser served as deputy director in the Michigan Department of Commerce during the Blanchard administration. Michigan Future aspires to be a source of new ideas on how Michigans can succeed in the information age. What new ideas are you finding?
From the beginning, we've been trying to be a catalyst for sort of making the transition away from the industrial age. But over the last several years, we've done sort of some work that basically is organized around the notion that if you look at the places around the country, North America, most of the advanced economies around the world, is that they're concentrated in knowledge-based industries. And a lot of that obviously also means in sort of the Michigan context is accepting the fact that you cannot have a high prosperity economy that's based on factories, which is really difficult for us to let go of since that's really been, you know, what Michigan has done for 100 years.
Is that the fundamental challenge, Lou, to making that change from the industrial economy to the knowledge or idea economy, letting go of the past?
I think so. To the degree that we in this state continue to believe that there's some way that we can get back to this place where you can build a broad middle class of relatively low-skill factory workers, it really sort of retards your ability to make the transition. And, of course, in a place like Michigan, it's likely to be really difficult for us to let go because we invented sort of the industrial age in America, and it was so terrific for us. So, and yet if we don't let go of it, the odds are that we're going to continue to lag the country.
You say that you need a vision change at both the leadership level and the individual level. Sort out for me how much of the response to what's happening in the economy and the shift that needs to be made, how much of that should be driven by policy changes, how much of it should be driven by programmatic changes, and how much of the response needs to be personal and cultural?
Well, what we've ended up concluding in this new report that we did called A New Agenda for New Michigan is that culture trumps policy, that ultimately if you look at the places around the country that are doing the best, it turns out that at the policy level and policy and programmatic level both, they're doing a variety of things. I mean, they're almost more distinguished by sort of their differences rather than the similarities when it comes to policy and programs. But what is true of those places, we believe, is that they end up being places that highly value learning, being entrepreneurial, and being welcoming to all, that those are sort of the three what we describe as cultural values that seems to be the core characteristics of places that are doing well.
You emphasize the value of entrepreneurship.
Yep.
Far more than most writers and researchers in this field, and I agree with you. Describe how you believe entrepreneurship will grow in importance.
Well, and we're using the word entrepreneurial or entrepreneurial spirit in a sense that is broader than just starting businesses, although mm-hmm. we need to start businesses at a much better rate than we have in the past. I mean, Michigan, and I think a lot of the Great Lakes or Midwest, you know, 100 years ago, I mean, we were the Silicon Valley. We were the places that was creating new industries, and somehow or other, we've lost that. So starting businesses matter. our notion is that one of the characteristics of sort of a flat world economy is the disappearance of stable long-term employment. And that ultimately, to the degree that you view yourself as getting connected to a job or even an occupation or an enterprise for a long period of time, that is sort of going to be the not a path to success in the future. So what we've ended up saying to folks is we've used the analogy that if we used to think of careers as being like climbing a ladder, that increasingly in a flat world economy, what we're all going to need to become is more like rock climbers when it comes to putting a career together. And rock climbers are really going to be folks who are resourceful. They're able to spot opportunities and then have the skills to take advantage of opportunities. And that rock climbing and sometimes is going to involve taking a step sideways, maybe a step down, you know, maybe starting over again. And all of that to us is characterized sort of by an entrepreneurial mentality rather than an entitlement mentality.
Mm-hmm. You write in that report, people will do well based on their ability to be continuous learners. Yep. Past guarantors of a good income, your college degree, seniority, unions, etc. are of declining value. The only reliable employment security you will have is your current skills compared with those around the globe competing for the same job. Now, with that statement, Lou, you cleverly put college graduates in the same boat with union workers. Your answer to that is continuous learning. How do you see cities and states helping make that a reality?
I guess we'd say first and foremost is this notion of celebrating and promoting the value of lifelong learning. You know, Deming, the quality guru, you know, who became famous in sort of the 80s mm-hmm. and 90s for the work that he had done in Japan, mm-hmm. spent an enormous amount of time apparently with all of his clients before he took them on as clients, trying to get them to really understand what business they were in. And his description of the business that education institutions should be in is instilling the love of learning.
Mm-hmm.
So that really to us is at the core of this need to develop sort of lifelong learning. It is the notion that that learning has got to be something that all of us learn how to do but also enjoy doing, because we're going to have to do it for a lifetime. That to us is really sort of the core challenge that faces sort of all of our education institutions. And by and large, we have a set of education institutions now who don't have anything like that on their sort of description of what they're all about.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Lou Glaser. He's president of Michigan Future. In that report, you also redefine the concept of infrastructure in the knowledge economy. What do you see, Lou, growing in importance in terms of infrastructure?
Right. I mean, it's not that we say that physical infrastructure is irrelevant. You know, we've tended to think of infrastructure as sort of roads or transportation systems, water, sewer, I guess to some degree utilities. Our sense is increasingly in a flat world that the infrastructure that matters most are connections to sort of the world. So digital becomes enormously important, that places that have the best connections to the internet have enormous advantages. So digital infrastructure matters enormously. International airports matter enormously, even though a lot of stuff can be done digitally. There still is an enormous need on the part of enterprises to have personal connections with folks around the globe. And then ultimately, what we've ended up concluding in this report, the question that we ask ourselves in doing this report is what really matters in better positioning Michigan to succeed in the knowledge economy. And our answer was talent, that the notion is that the places with the largest concentration of talent, where talent is defined as some combination of knowledge, creativity, and entrepreneurship, that those places win. And what we say in the infrastructure is that one of the ways that seems to be particularly important in terms of attracting and retaining talent is what we call green infrastructure. It is sort of out-of-door leisure time opportunities that seems to be particularly important to talent and the young talent. So the infrastructure that we think matters most going forward, digital, international airports, and green infrastructure.
I want to come back to your conclusion about green infrastructure.
Yep.
On what did you base that conclusion that green infrastructure has more importance to the attraction and retention of young talent?
Some of it is just basically taking it. One of the things that we did in the report is that we ended up really taking a look at the metropolitan areas, which we think is the right geography when you're talking about the economy, taking a look at those places that had the highest per capita income. And it turns out places that have high per capita income have three common characteristics. One is they're over-concentrated compared to the country in these knowledge-based industries. The second is as a region, they have a high percentage of their adults who have a four-year degree, which is the only real metric for talent that's available. It's not the best, but it's the only one. Mm-hmm. And third, pretty interestingly, they all have central cities that have a high proportion of its residents with a four-year degree. So mm-hmm. And the way we came up with green infrastructure is more at looking at characteristics of successful regions that's the basic methodology.
What has been the reaction in Michigan to your advice to let go of the past and move into the future? Who resists that and who's with you on it?
Yeah, the report's only out a couple of months, so my guess is it's too soon to tell. The reaction so far has been pretty positive, although the proof in the pudding to us is going to be where people actually take ownership of the ideas and begin to actually work on sort of the agenda, the framework at least of the agenda that we develop, rather than just saying, nice report, interesting report. It's the doing rather than mm-hmm. sort of the compliments that really matter to us. The resistance historically in this state has been pretty broad. You know, what we basically say in the report is that there are two pillars of sort of middle-class America, middle-class Michigan, that the flat world is eroding, if not eliminating. One is sort of good-paying jobs for low skills, not just factory work, but that's certainly part of it. And the second is this long-term stable employment. By and large, people in Michigan don't want to let go of either of it. Giving up on that's pretty hard. My guess is we're making small progress, but the resistance is still pretty strong. I mean, if people had their choice in Michigan, they'd sort of want the flat world to go away. Mm-hmm. And yet what we're basically saying is it's not only is it a reality, but the forces that are driving the flat world, globalization and technology, in many ways are at the early stages that you haven't seen anything yet. So mm-hmm. that ultimately the only option is to get aligned. We're someplace between denial and acceptance at the moment here in Michigan, but we're sure not to the point where we've taken ownership and are really acting on it by and large.
What impact did you find taxes having on state economies?
Well, first of all, we don't think there is such things as state economies. What we basically argue in the report is that economies are regional. They're organized at the metropolitan area level. States are political jurisdictions. So, the most interesting evidence of that, I think, is if you look at the list of the metro areas in the country that have populations of a million or more, the place with the highest per capita income is in California. The place with the lowest per capita income is in California. So, and you see those differences in states right across the country, sort of same state policies, some metro areas doing well, some metro areas not doing well, by and large, small town and rural areas not doing so well. So we don't really have a sense that states, when you talk about the economy, that states are all that relevant. But then when you look at the data and you look at the places that have high prosperity, and particularly places that have high per capita income and high concentrations in knowledge-based industries, by and large, they are states that are characterized by higher rather than lower taxes. And if you look at the places with the lowest taxes, they have lousy economies. So this notion that somehow or other, if states just got their tax rates right, that you would have a prosperous economy is simply not supported by real-world data.
Let me ask you, Lou, on this point that states are not all that relevant to right. economies. States do make decisions. They're invested in historical decisions about where to put education institutions yep. and invest in those and make them research-oriented universities. Yep. Does that not have an effect sure. on local or metro economies?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think
and those are big decisions. Those are big financial decisions.
Yeah, they are huge decisions. And so clearly how states – how and where states invest sort of the resources that they have available to them matters. It's just that it matters less than a lot of us think. I mean, it's pretty interesting. If you look at research universities, and we make a big deal of research universities in the report, we basically end up saying that higher ed in general and research universities in particular, at least in Michigan's case, although we think it's probably true across the country, are in many ways the most important asset, particularly public assets, that communities have going forward. But in terms of research universities, the great research universities that are not part of a big metro area have very little economic spinoff effect. It's research universities that are part of big metro areas that are connected to international airports and all of the rest of the amenities that are important in terms of retaining and attracting talent and all the other agglomerations that are there. They're the ones that have sort of the big economic impact. So even with something as important as universities and research universities, the fact that the state chose to locate it in community X as opposed to community Y is not determinative. It's all the rest of the stuff that goes with it that really turns out to matter. So I don't want to leave the impression that we think states are irrelevant. All that we're saying is that if you're talking about an economy, the geography you need to look at is the metropolitan area. Now, metropolitan areas are clearly affected by state policies towards the metro area.
You've made revitalizing Michigan's central cities a priority for Michigan Future. I assume that's because of what you found when you looked at the successful high per capita metros in the country. Give me an idea of the magnitude of that challenge in Michigan.
Oh, well, the Michigan challenge is extraordinary. I mean, if you look at these successful metropolitan areas, they tend to have central cities that have in the central city, the proportion of the central city residents who have a four-year degree tends to be from 35 to 50%, Seattle and San Francisco being the ones that are at 50%. Detroit's at 11%. It's of the 70 cities in the country with populations of 250,000, so there's 70, Detroit's 68th. So at the moment, in our biggest metro area, the Detroit metropolitan area, which includes Ann Arbor, by the way, you have a central city that is not serving this role of retaining and attracting talent. So we got a long, long ways to go.
What are the strategies you think are most promising?
Well, ultimately, what we've ended up saying is that if you're looking at central cities to play this role of retaining and attracting talent, and by and large, the role that they're playing is that they're places where sort of talented individuals, talented households, which, you know, as we say, in terms of data, you can best define by four-year degrees, are locating for those households that don't have kids. So they tend to either be young or empty nesters that are centering in central cities. Those folks end up living in sort of 24/7 neighborhoods, high activity neighborhoods, sort of mixed use, mixed density neighborhoods that that have an active street life and that are very walkable. So our focus has been on the notion that you need to begin to develop those kinds of neighborhoods. And then in a place like Detroit, in many ways, we're really just starting. We're there. We don't have a history of those neighborhoods in Detroit. That's part of our problem is a lot of cities have had those neighborhoods. Historically, they've declined somewhat. They're now coming back. In Detroit, in many ways, we're really trying to create them from scratch. That's really where the focus has got to be on creating sort of mixed-use, high-density, walkable, safe neighborhoods that are attractive places for talented people, largely in households without kids.
Early in her administration, your current Governor Jennifer Granholm, stood side by side with Richard Florida. They both donned a set of shades, and they launched an initiative that she called Cool Cities. What was that all about, and what has been the result?
So by and large, that was about, at its core, I think, creating these kinds of neighborhoods. You know, and the program continues to exist, but by and large, our assessment would be that the program has been a positive, but maybe less impactful than it could have been if it had a higher priority. Part of the reason it doesn't have a higher priority is that sort of the legislature and sort of the Republicans have not embraced the program at all, so it's never been bipartisan. The two other problems was, as the economy got into more and more trouble, largely because sort of manufacturing really took a big hit here in Michigan and the domestic auto industry ended up getting slaughtered. That sort of the focus moved away from sort of cool cities and to more towards sort of things trying to save sort of the factory and the domestic auto industry. And secondly, the program always was viewed as a statewide program rather than so that you tried – the effort was to try to create these kinds of neighborhoods across the state rather than really in your core central cities. I guess our assessment is a positive from a policy standpoint, but not as focused and not as sharp in terms of attention and priority as it probably needed. And, you know, one of our efforts now with this new report is to try once again to position sort of the creation of these sort of vibrant central city neighborhoods as an absolute essential to growing a prosperous Michigan. Mm-hmm. Most people in Michigan don't believe that.
Lou, at the same time you talk about convincing the people of Michigan to leave behind things that are no longer working and understanding that the changes going on in the broader economy, you're launching a high school designed to connect students to good-paying jobs in the automotive industry. How do you square those two, and why did you feel the need to jump into what is always a very tough endeavor? Charter schools or any kind of schools.
Right. You know, we sort of have sort of the organization Michigan Future has sort of has these two areas that we've always worked in. One is this being a catalyst for the transition to the knowledge economy. The other is something that we've ended up calling connecting the urban poor to work. So the school really comes out of our poverty, the poverty part of what we do. And really, it was a request, a great request from the Mott Foundation, which is one of our funders. Mm-hmm. Mott, and the observation that the folks at Mott had is that historically in Michigan, the path for a lot of low-income, particularly African-American families, to the middle class was the auto industry. Mm-hmm. And as factory jobs decline, the reality is that a big part of the knowledge industry in Michigan is in automotive. It's in the pre-production and post-production side of the automotive industry. It's in engineering and design, research and development, marketing, procurement, logistics. And they basically ask us, how is it that we recreate the auto industry, but the new auto industry, the knowledge auto industry, as a path to the middle class for sort of low-income central city residents? So that's where the school comes from. If you look at the knowledge industries that are here now, they are largely connected to the auto industry. Now, obviously, you know, we just got Google announcing that they're going to make a major location, a major investment here in Ann Arbor. Pfizer is now here with the research and development. So we need to diversify our economy into other industries. But the pre- and post-production part of the auto industry is the anchor of the knowledge economy in Michigan at this point, and we've got to figure out ways in which we can connect sort of low-income kids to that economy, and that's what the school is all about.
Lou, thanks so much for being with us on Smart City.
My pleasure.
Lou Glazer is president of Michigan Future. After a short break, we'll return to talk with Mick McManus of Maya about designing public places with the public in mind. And we'll visit with Otis White about one surprising city where light rail is a hit. Smart City is made possible in part by the support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Regional Chamber, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Many cities, Otis, are considering new light rail systems, but there's a lot of skepticism about their cost and their ability to attract riders. But you found a surprising success.
Yeah. Probably the most successful new rail transit system in the country is the one in Dallas. It's called DART, stands for Dallas Area Rapid Transit. It has just celebrated its 10th anniversary of the opening of its first rail line, and it has really, really taken off. It's now 45 miles in length. It's about half built. It has begun truly reshaping the community in the sense that it has unleashed a wave of development along its rail corridors, And it's right about where the original forecast said it would be for passenger loads. And it's already the fifth largest light rail system in the country, so it's grown very fast. But it sure came close to unraveling several times along the way. And the reason is, for regions that don't have a lot of experience with rail transit, it's really hard to imagine how it can change things for the better. A lot of people in Dallas, as you probably can imagine, back in the 80s, thought that rail transit would never get people out of cars, that it would be a gigantic boondoggle, that it would bankrupt the taxpayers, and that it would just simply take too long for it to have any kind of impact on the community. While it is an enormously successful rail system today, it sure gives you a lot of lessons about how hard it can be to be successful.
Who would have ever thought light rail could be successful in Dallas, Texas?
Well, it sort of flies in the face of our idea of Texans, doesn't it? A place that, after all, supplies one of the ingredients that makes automobiles go. But Dallas has proven how sprawling, oil-conscious places can also be models for how to get around on the rail.
Very interesting and very encouraging. Otis, we'll talk to you next week. Thanks.
Thanks, Carol.
You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Mick McManus is president and CEO of Maya, although he likes to think of himself as chief mad scientist. Maya is a design consultancy and technology research lab headquartered in Pittsburgh. Mick's work has been recognized with numerous national awards, and he is a frequent international lecturer on experience design. Mick, tell me about the work you do at Maya.
Maya is a design consultancy. We actually specialize in technology products, technological experiences, and making them easy to use. We call it taming complexity.
You conducted a comprehensive assignment for the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh to help the library rethink its relationship with its customers. How do you begin such an inquiry?
Well, that was a really interesting project in that we were actually approached by one of the architects. They had hired five different architects to renovate five different Carnegie Library branches in different neighborhoods. And the architects were all done with the main branch. They were really excited about the design of it. Well, they were done with the design. And they said, we want to do this really neat multimedia thing, video projection, maybe plasma screens or something, right at the entrance. And they asked the librarians, well, what do you want to say at the entrance to the library? And nobody really knew what you were supposed to say. Like, what was the right thing to say when you enter a library? And what was the right thing to say when you leave? So they were kind of stumped because they had gone to a traditional library consultancy who had programmed the whole place in terms of where do you put books, where do you put the desks and things like that, and how do you inventory it. But no one really had an idea of what the experience from the user's point of view should be. And so they approached us and they said, hey, could you come and help? We actually did something called a mile in your shoes, and we gave different people, some people that were first-time library customers, some people that were old hands at the library, we gave them missions, and we said, go ahead and walk through the library, and for the first-time customer, you don't even have a library card, but you have to find this bestseller, and we're going to give you a disposable camera to take pictures as you go, and we're going to give you a little map so you can kind of draw where you are when you take a picture. And we just want you to map out your experience trying to get a book. And, you know, they're all used to going to Barnes & Nobles and Borders and things like that. We grabbed the people and we had them go through the library. And what was amazing was it was something like 22 steps to get this book. The maps were just hilarious to look at because they were zip-zipping all over the library. And what it turned out was that the libraries had been developed 100 years ago to be archives for books. Books were the currency of information back then. But today, books, CDs, DVDs, all sorts of different things contain all this information. And so it sort of grew up out of 100 years of being a big archive, a big warehouse for books. So unless you were a really smart library user that knew all the secret handshakes and all the codes and knew the secret passages, you couldn't find what you were looking for. So that was our first step.
Now, when you looked at the photographs that were made with the disposable cameras, and you looked at the maps that these users had made to map their experiences, what do you begin to look for at Maya to discern the confusion and the rubs and the things that you can improve?
Well, that's an interesting question. What happens is, if you think about a library, it has three different kinds of interfaces. You know, I'll use interface. That's kind of what we think about when we talk about the web. But actually, whenever a human touches something, that's an interface. So if you walk into a library, the physical building is your interface. You browse it. You look around. You see books that you're interested in. Books that are next to other books attract you because they're next to each other. You say, oh, look at this. And you serendipitously discover things, just like you're browsing online. You organize the world by this kind of 3D interface that we call reality. So that's one interface. And so first we look for signage and wayfinding and things that help you in that interface kind of find what you're looking for. Another interface in the library is the catalog, you know, the sort of categorization system. You go, the old-fashioned way was big drawers that you would pull out and you'd look through the Dewey Decimal System. But the new libraries are all organized by the Library of Congress system in many cases. In fact, the Carnegie Libraries are organized that way as well. And then the third interface is the people. You know, you walk up to a librarian, a reference librarian, they know a lot of things, but you don't know which one is a reference librarian and which one is just a page that's putting books back on the shelf or someone from the administrative side. You kind of think everyone in the library is a librarian. So those three interfaces, we kind of studied how well they worked by themselves and how well they worked transferring from one to another. Because when you walk into a library, you might find something, but you might not. And if you don't, then you're going to transfer from looking around in the physical space to talking to a person or going online. And we discovered all these places where you just sort of fell off a cliff. And we called that a breakpoint analysis. It was a breakpoints between the different interfaces. And did they get you closer when you bridged from one interface to another to your goal, or did they take you farther away? Did you kind of fall off a cliff? Mm-hmm. And that was the first real big discovery.
I'm curious, Mick, when you see a temporary sign, or you see a lot of temporary signs, which is not unusual, do you consider that a failure?
Well, you know what I think? That's really the people that work in the system hacking the system. And so people go back and they put up a bright pink, you know, Xerox sign, or they put up a note with a hand scribble. In my opinion, that's hacking. And we actually think that's really interesting because you discover where there are all sorts of little problems. We did a booklet for them called Signs and Wonders, and it was over 3,000 signs that we found across the different libraries that we visited.
Mm-hmm. How articulate are customers about their own experiences and the experiences they seek?
Well, that's a tough one. I don't think customers typically know what they don't know or know what, you know, there's a sort of unmet, unvoiced needs and desires that are really hard to pull out of somebody just by asking them questions. That's why we like to put people in the context. We do ethnography. We sit there and watch them as they're doing things, and they'll tell us they do something one way, but what they actually do with their physical bodies and what they actually kind of end up stumbling through is entirely different, and that's what we're looking for. Those opportunities.
You've talked about disposable cameras, mapping the experiences. You've talked about your own photography with the Signs and Wonders. What other sorts of techniques do you use to analyze these kinds of situations?
Well, we also did shadowing, where we actually shadowed the librarians and we shadowed users so that we could just watch what was happening. We spent all day long at some of the libraries over different times, just sitting behind a librarian, seeing what people asked them, seeing what kinds of questions they got, what they had to do, how easy it was for them to connect people to the right information. So that's another technique.
Did the architects resist you at all?
Well, they were the ones who brought us in, one of the five architects. And the other architects were just so hungry for information. So you know what it turns out? When you're 10 miles away from the library, what you really care about is knowing if there is even a library around and do they have fresh information. And when you're right by the front of the library, you care if it's open. You want to know if it's open and does it have fresh information again. People want to know it's got something that they need. When you're inside the library, right when you walk in, you want to know what's happening, what's the scope of the library, what can I do in the library, what can I not do in the library, so you can decide if you can get done what you want to get done. And then what's happening in terms of materials and what's happening in terms of activities. We discovered a ton of people who just wanted to know, hey, there's a book reading this afternoon, or there's a kid's playtime, you know, in 20 minutes. So immediately, what's happening in the library, what's happening in the building, and then what's happening out in the library system and out in the community. That's what you want to know when you walk in. And when we told the architects this, they were just so excited because that gave them direction. You know, they were just hungry because they needed answers, and the librarians didn't quite know how to say it because they were so close to the system.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Mick McManus. He is president and CEO of Maya. Once you've collected the data, Mick, and you've analyzed it, does the solution tend to be obvious, or Is there a creative leap still necessary to get at the recommendations?
Well, sometimes the solution's obvious. Sometimes it's something that other industries use, but nobody's really applied to the library. And we don't really focus on one particular industry. We have clients like Merrill Lynch, Panasonic, Hewlett-Packard. You know, it's across a bunch of different places, to medical device companies, to the library, to the post office. And sometimes it's just taking really great innovation that's been happening in some other field and applying it into the library space. Other times, it's pretty obvious. Once you finish it, sometimes people are like, yeah, that's duh, that's what we should have done. But nobody sort of had the energy to do it, or they didn't quite know the structure to frame it. So we ended up organizing all the different things that we discovered along a sort of a graph, along the one dimension, the X dimension, we put how important it was to the user. So if it was way out on that graph, it was really important to the user. And on the vertical dimension, we put how expensive is it or how timely is it to actually accomplish. Because some things, you can come up with great ideas, but they're so complicated or so expensive, or they really don't have any ecology to them. They won't be sustained. That calculates into a cost. It's really expensive to maintain, or it's expensive to create. And when you look at this graph, you find out that if it's really important to the user and it's not very expensive, do it now. Mm-hmm. You know, it gives you a really easy way to organize what you should do first. And if it's really expensive and the user doesn't care about it, they never expressed any interest, it's not for them. You're doing it for some other reason.
Mm-hmm.
So if it was way out on that graph, it was really important to the user. And on the vertical dimension, we put how expensive is it or how timely is it to actually accomplish. Because some things, you can come up with great ideas, but they're so complicated or so expensive, or they really don't have any ecology to them. They won't be sustained. That calculates into a cost. It's really expensive to maintain, or it's expensive to create. And when you look at this graph, you find out that if it's really important to the user and it's not very expensive, do it now. Mm-hmm. You know, it gives you a really easy way to organize what you should do first. And if it's really expensive and the user doesn't care about it, they never expressed any interest, it's not for them. You're doing it for some other reason.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to the development plan. What are they going to do first? What are they going to do second? What are they going to do down the road? And one of the things that we recommended was going back and doing the same study after the library opened. They had a huge gala opening. They had huge increases in people attending the library. The architects did some wonderful jobs in the different libraries. And we said, okay, go back. And there were some new things that we discovered that were pretty exciting.
And what were those new things?
Well, you know, so one of the things that happened is they put up some maps for the stacks. The stacks were in the main library, a five-story section of shelves with all the books. And the library itself is only three stories. So this five-story section is kind of grafted onto a three-story building. So there are kind of half floors in between floors. And it's very confusing. And the architects kind of approached it from the point of view that we all talked about, and they addressed those problems. But once it was all installed and once people were using it, it still was a problem. It just turned out to be a really confusing system. And so we had to come up with more signage. And really just, in many cases, we discovered that architects are almost hesitant to put up wayfinding,
mm-hmm.
or hesitant to put up very descriptive text. You know, they want to put it up in 12-point Bodoni or 14-point Helvetic, you know, very
sure.
small. But in reality, the users want context. You know, they want some simple things that tell them what to do where they're at the point. You know, there was all this talk about what should the reference librarian's desk be called. And for years, it's been called the reference librarian's desk. And what should the checkout area, the customer service area be called? And it's been called checkout. It's been called customer service. So we went and actually checked and asked tons of people how they reacted to different sorts of phrases and words. And so we did a study of what we would call the lexicon, the sort of language that you use. And first of all, we discovered that nobody knows what a reference librarian is these days, or less people do. So we changed the naming right over their desks, and we changed it to ask a librarian. So it was a verb. You can ask a librarian. And then we listed the three things you could ask them. Here are some things you can ask them about. You can find out about new books. You can discover how to vet your information, because the internet doesn't give you a great way to vet or really find out if some information's true, but the librarians are wonderful at it. So by listing a few things, you kind of give the customer at least a framework. Oh, this is what I can do when I stand over here.
Is the confusion you found at the Carnegie Library typical of other public services?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think so. A few years ago, two of our designers, they take the bus all the time. You know, they live in the city, and they take the bus to our office, and they kept going to the bus site, you know, the free site that tells you where the buses are and when they get in. And they were so confused by the schedule, and it was so impossible for them to be able to find what they were looking for in terms of when is a bus going to be here. And, you know, I want to know if a bus is going to be here in 10 minutes, and if I can get from this bus to this bus and make a connection. that they ended up rehacking it and building their own site called bus.maya.com that literally you could just type in where you were located, and you could look on your desktop. There were little buses that would come up on your desktop, and you could just, at a glance, you could see if a bus was coming. At one point, they put on a little pop-up window that would say, start running. they knew that if a bus was, you know, three blocks down, if they ran, they could make it down to their bus. So it was just kind of a fun, different hack, but it was just this pain, you know, with just using a standard service, because maybe it's developed by the IT department, or maybe it's developed by somebody who's got a particular mission, but they're not necessarily versed in how to understand users and really focus on a user-centered design.
Has the Pittsburgh Transit Authority contacted you to say, hey, let us use this?
Well, just this year, we started talking with them about it. You know, we did this probably 2 or 3 years ago, and we've just been using it. And if you were to Google, buses in Pittsburgh, you'd end up finding ours was the top list because more people used it than the Ride Gold site. So this year, they've said they'd really like to get involved in it. We have a separate effort called the Information Commons Work, which is taking a bunch of these silos of information that are collected by communities. We pay tax dollars, and so all the tax dollars go towards collecting information on cancer and collecting information on toxic releases and chemicals and, you know, the EPA and health issues and all sorts of things, but they're in all these silos. And so this bus project is going to be flowed into a larger theme called the Information Commons, where you kind of free all the information into one consistent information space that you can then interface with. So we just started doing something with the Department of Human Services, and it's a site called humanservices.net, and it takes the bus information that we scraped off of the bus site, and it takes the human service information, you know, where does United Way have programs, where do other people have programs, and we wove it all together because it turns out the people that need human services often don't have cars.
Mm-hmm.
So by taking those two or three different silos and putting them together, we made it very easy for people that work in the human services realm to be able to give them answers. Because up to this point, they've been flipping through different books and catalogs,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, trying to hack it together themselves.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Do you think, Mick, having looked at a number of public realm experiences now, is there a way to generally categorize the problem areas?
Oh, gosh, that's a tough question. You know, I think a lot of it boils down to really looking at it from a user-centered point of view. If you just try to follow a user towards their goals and you look at all the places they fall off a cliff, you're going to discover things. We recently did a study of one of the hospitals in the area, and it was unbelievable. You drop off somebody at the emergency room, you go park your car, you can't get to the emergency room going through the hospital without going through a door that says nobody can go through this door.
Wow.
You know, you literally can't. So I think just saying, this is the goal. I want to drop off somebody and I want to go park and then I'm going to go and try to find them again. And then following that through, I think you discover an awful lot.
Is there a public realm experience design project that you would really like to tackle?
That's a tough one. You know, I think the library was really exciting just because we think it's so important. It's a community. It's a place where you get together. It sort of lost its way, I think, a few years ago, and now I think it's finding it again in terms of, you know, I think the Googleization of the world kind of scared the librarians quite a bit, and yet it was created by reference librarians in some respects, some of the deep background. I think the library was exciting. I'd love to help out with hospitals more. You know, I think that that's just the healthcare system in America, I think, is really painful, and just feeling like you're actually being taken care of and you know where things are going. The second part is just really getting around towns when you're new. I came down here from Chicago, and Chicago's kind of a grid. It's pretty easy to get around. You get to Pittsburgh, and everything's hills and valleys and curves, and people say, oh, you turn left at that barn that's not there anymore. You know, it's confusing. So just helping new people really serendipitously discover things and targeted way to find things, I think could really connect the community tighter, and mm-hmm. I'd love to work more on that.
It seems that many of the public realm experiences that were once enjoyed by everyone have been abandoned by those who have financial options to do it elsewhere, whether it's public transit, whether it's parks and community centers, whether it's libraries. It seems that many people with financial options have opted to go elsewhere to a paid environment, which means it's a more controlled environment in many ways. If cities really got serious about experience design, do you think that would help return people with financial options to the public realm?
No, I do. I think it would be a big step in the right direction. I think that if you were to just study the way the experiences work and the way that you can weave together multiple kinds of experiences now with technology, with low technology, it doesn't have to be complicated, but just different ways that you can connect things, you could make it a much more interesting place. Once we renovated all those libraries, they had a huge uptick in, you know, their whole thing was we would love to target latchkey kids and kids that are growing up so that they learn about the library and they know it is a resource because it's much more powerful resource. If you go into a Barnes & Noble, and I don't want to rip on them or anything, I think it's a wonderful experience, but they have like 10 nonfiction books compared to 100,000 in a normal library. They really have a very small collection of nonfiction books. It's not very well organized because it doesn't have to be. It's like 12 shelves or something. I mean, I'm exaggerating. But the point is the depth that a library has in nonfiction and in the people that are honestly trying to help you find it. You know, they don't have some, they're not sponsored. The librarians aren't sponsored by somebody. Their job is to vet the information and connect the information for you. And they're taught how to ask the right questions. If you do that, you start realizing that a lot more people come. At the main library in Pittsburgh, they've had a huge uptick in people coming. You know, they wanted the kids that are learning, but they also wanted patrons. You know, the library is self-sponsored by patrons. And that was the other thing they were looking for. And so part of what we discovered was you needed little community places. The architects built in a little veranda with a bamboo garden and put in a cafe, and they made a rule, you don't have to worry about where you take your coffee. Just take it anywhere you want, just like in the Barnes & Noble. And pretty soon, they started having these wonderful things. People are having weddings there. They're having evenings. They're having, you know, wine tasting sessions. It's really increasing the community involvement because it's this beautiful building. It's a wonderful 100-year-old, you know, place. And that's what the communities have. They have these wonderful assets. But they're not treating them like that, and they're not thinking about how you can create that experience. And experience, I think, overall is becoming more and more important. People want something rich. They want to get connected.
Mick, I'm so glad we could talk. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Carol, I really appreciate you taking the time. This was fun.
Mick McManus is president and CEO of Maya. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. In a sea of lies, scandals, half-truths, and satire, it's often difficult to trust the goodness and quality of character in others. CityView's commentator Walker Smith explains that while being sentimental may be viewed as naive, it's that kind of faith that we all long for.
There's almost no greater insult these days than being called sentimental. It suggests that you lack the sophistication and intellectual prowess to spot the duplicity or irony of people and institutions professing honesty, goodness, or piety. And who can argue with these claims against sentimentality? Scandals and hypocrisy are everywhere. Politicians and business leaders betray our trust. The secret lives of religious leaders mock our beliefs. The narcissism and arrogance of sports figures and celebrities strain our loyalties. Even our national democratic ideals are tainted by profiteering and criminal misconduct abroad. So the prevailing sensibility is one of satire. Nothing can be taken at face value. Everything has a spin to it. Only the foolish fall for the ways in which others manipulate their emotions and credulity. The real news comes from blogs and tabloids where balloons are popped and pretensions parodied. Nothing is sacrosanct anymore because nothing is trustworthy. And we are comfortable with this. The jokes are funny and the cons get exposed. Satire seems to be the only attitude appropriate to the deceits and insincerities lurking behind every high-minded conviction and ideal. If we couldn't ridicule it, how could we cope? But it's not just coping that makes satire our prevailing sensibility. There is also a broader social dynamic of postmodernism lurking beneath the surface. We avoid sentimentality because we no longer believe in the high ideals that once commanded respect and obedience. Collectively, we have lost faith, belief, and conviction. Yet notwithstanding the know-it-all sense of postmodernism that pervades our lives, we yearn for something else. We don't long for satire. We don't wish for more mockery and derision. We long for sentimentality. We want happy endings to be true. We want to have faith. We want to let our guard down and give ourselves over to something sentimental and inspiring. It's not our nature to ridicule. It's our nature to believe. This requires giving others the benefit of the doubt and trusting that the best in others will prevail. Unfortunately, trust in others is as low as it has ever been. A 2005 Pew survey found only 32% agreed that most people could be trusted. In the 2004 General Social Survey, a mere 37% agreed. And in a 2005 Gallup poll, only 45% agreed. By whatever measure, less than half of us are willing to give others the benefit of the doubt. No wonder we avoid sentimentality. The only way to turn this around is to start with ourselves. Surveys by both Pew and Yankelovich have found that 80% believe incivility is a serious problem in American life, yet 40% admit to behaving this way themselves. In a 1998 Gallup poll, only 30% said they say thank you at least some of the time. To think well of others, we must first give others the opportunity to think well of us. What we can find in ourselves to do are the things we know that others can do too. And that, at least, is something worth gushing about, sentimental though it may be. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for our podcast, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive is supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders working to speed innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation's investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.